Chapter 3 0940 hours, November 7th, 2531, Military Calendar. Groom Bridge 34 System, near construction platform 966A, decommissioned. Spartan 051, Kurt, jumped into utter emptiness. It was a 100-kilometer drop to the moon under his feet. He mentally made the adjustment to the free-floating world of space, and noted that technically, there was no under or above in space, just vectors, masses, and velocities. He switched on his reverse angle camera and saw Kelly and Fred jump from the lock of the prowler after him. He knew not to turn his head to look. The motion would make him gyrate out of control. Besides, in the vacuum-enhanced variant of Mjolnir armor, his mobility was a fraction of normal. A green status light winked on, confirming they were all on the same vector. They'd coast for several kilometers before they activated long-range thruster packs. Although slow, there were two good reasons to be cautious. First, when their prowler circumference had re-entered normal space, the nav officer had picked up an echo, a partial ship silhouette, prowler class. He had dismissed this as an echo from their re-entry to normal space that had bounced off the moon. The nav officer had assured them there was nothing to worry about. Still, the anomaly bugged Kurt. In case there was another ship, Kurt wanted to be well away before igniting PAX. No need to needlessly give away the stealth ship's position. Second, they had detected an inert comm satellite on the dark side of the moon. Something you'd expect if the system was being monitored for a sneak attack. No signal had emitted from the thing. The circumference had jammed and then fried it with a burst from a pulse laser. Kurt just made the assumption this simple recon mission would be hot. That way, he'd be happy to be disappointed. He activated the single-beam laser team comm system and said, ETA to day-night demarcation in 5 minutes. System check thrusters. Kurt ran his own diagnostic. They couldn't take any chances with the PAX. Designed for long-range, deep-space operations, it was one of the riskiest pieces of equipment they'd been trained on. Even with triple redundancy in nav system and stabilizers, one accident, and there was enough compressed triaminohydrazine in the double fuel tanks to propel you so far and so fast off course, rescue would be an astronomically remote possibility. Or as Chief Mendes had put it, start tumbling in this gear. Start praying. Green status lights winked back at Kurt. ETA 3 minutes, he said. Roger, Kelly replied, and then she added, something wrong?
No,
Kurt said. Fred's voice came over the comm.
When you say no like that, you mean yes.
Just a feeling, he admitted.
Silence hissed over their linked single-beam comms. Kurt watched in his rear-angle display as Kelly and Fred activated their MA-5B assault rifles. A data cable linked each rifle to their TPAC microprocessor to give the proper counter-thrust when the weapon fired. Kurt sighed, momentarily fogging his faceplate. Now they were jumpy too. But maybe that wasn't a bad thing. Too many things weren't adding up. There was the Echo and the inactive spy satellite. And why had CENTCOM picked them to go on a low-risk recon mission? This was just a simple look to check out reported suspicious activity at a decommissioned USNC shipyard. Sure, a long spacewalk was a high-risk maneuver, but not something you'd send 3 Spartans on.
Coming up on the Twilight Zone, Kurt said. Go to radio silent.
They drifted toward the razor line that marked night to day on the smooth, icy moon. There was no atmosphere, so the transition into the light would be quick. No sparkling sunrise, just a blinding flash of glare. They crossed into the light. Kurt's faceplate automatically polarized, and they got their first glimpse of the shipyard. Station Delphi was a floating city of welded scaffolding, cranes, docking pods, tubes, and grappling claws. There were no lights, no thermal emissions. Kurt snapped on his high-def recorder to capture every square meter of the derelict.
Whoever had been responsible for the station's decommissioning 3 years ago had done a sloppy job. There was a halo of debris. Spinning steel girders, bolts, and battle plate flashing as it caught and reflected the dull red sunlight from the distant binary stars. It looked deserted, so Kurt winked his green status light 3 times, the all clear, to resume single-beam communication. Fred sent an image over TeamCom, the skeletal frame of a partially constructed ship, about 3 times the size of their prowler. He said, "That TR steel alloy exposed to solar radiation is supposed to turn white." "It's silver," Kurt replied. "New construction?" "Check this out," Kelly said. She uploaded a series of images, capturing at increasing magnification a hull support cradle whose shape suggested the oddly angular structure of a stealth ship. Only this vessel had to be as large as a UNSC destroyer, which was impossible. A large stealth ship was an oxymoron. The bigger the ship, the more radiation leaked. The more thermals, the more stealth-coated surfaces had to be kept in perfect repair so they didn't reflect radar. "Send that image on a single beam back to the circumference," Kurt ordered. Kelly's status light went green. Kurt swept his left hand forward, gathering data on his sensors-encrusted glove. Still no thermals. No. Wait. As Station Delphi rotated slowly, a tiny white flare appeared. "Hotspot," he said, and tagged the region on his display, sending coordinates to Fred and Kelly. Kurt's hand twitched. Years of communicating by silent, efficient hand signals were something you just didn't unlearn. Talk, even using a single beam, didn't feel right on this mission. One simple wave, however, could send him spinning. And while his TPAC could compensate, Kurt wanted to continue to stealth without thrusters. Kelly moved her optics package on the spot, zoomed in, and they all saw a splash of rainbow colors. Kurt's radiation counter clicked wildly and then went dead. "Broad spectrum pulse," he reported. "I've seen one of those before," Fred told them. "They had to repair the Shaw Fujikawa Translite engine on the Magellan. It was a risky op. Those things aren't meant to be taken apart once they go active." Shaw Fujikawa engines allowed UNSC ships to leave normal space and plow through a dimensional subdomain colloquially known as slipstream space. Kurt had received rudimentary training in how it worked. The drive used particle accelerators to rip apart normal spacetime by generating micro black holes. Those holes evaporated via Hawking radiation in a nanosecond. The real quantum mechanical magic of the drive was how it manipulated those holes in spacetime, squeezing a 100,000-ton cruiser into slip space. The mathematics of how this worked and how a ship re-entered normal space was well beyond him. It was actually beyond most human geniuses. Kurt, however, did know this about Shaw Fujikawa drives. They were dangerous. There was radiation and anecdotal evidence that the normal laws of nature bent in close proximity to an active unit. "Update your mission logs and beam them back to the circumference," Kurt said. "We're going to take a closer look at that thing and confirm it's what Fred thinks it is before we call in hazmat." There was a slight delay before Kelly's and Fred's acknowledgement lights blinked green. Kurt activated his TPAC, puffed the thrusters, and angled toward Station Delphi. He tapped the attitude controls, adjusting pitch, roll, and yaw to avoid colliding with the bolts, beams, and tools spinning in the debris field. As they closed to within 100 meters of the sputtering, partially disassembled drive coils, his rear-angle camera fuzzed with static. "Getting interference here," Kurt said. "You two hold position. I'll scout it out."
"Roger," Kelly said.
There was an edge of concern in her voice.
"Grapple lines ready."
Kurt crept closer and got a glimpse into the heart of the drive. A near ultraviolet glow that didn't match the thermal output. It wasn't possible for a hole into slipspace to exist for more than a fraction of an instant. But he couldn't help feeling that's exactly what this was. And the closer he drifted, the more likely he'd get pulled in and forever lost. But that was just a feeling.
He hesitated. Kurt altered his direct trajectory and drifted toward a beam 30 meters over the Shaw Fujikawa engine. The space near the drive rippled like heat waves rising, impossible in a hard vacuum. His heads-up display flickered. Kelly spoke over the comm, her transmission filled with noise.
Your IFF tag is breaking up. It shows your position in multiple regions. Abort the recon. If your electronics malfunction...
The comm broke into a hiss of static. I've seen enough, Kurt said. Static answered him. I'm heading back. He tapped his altitude thrusters to spin around. The switch worked, but there was no action from the TPAC nozzles. Kurt released the controls. Triple redundancy in the processors or not, if his TPAC was affected by the nearby radiation, the last thing he wanted to do was give it a command to fire. He grasped the steel beam, and bracing, he waved back to his team. He couldn't see them out there, but he knew they were watching him. He knew they wouldn't let him down. With Kelly and Fred at his back, he could have been at the edge of hell, and they would have gotten him out. Of course, with a malfunctioning, partially deconstructed Shaw Fujikawa drive within spitting distance, that might be exactly where he stood. He spotted motion in the dark, a snaking orange and white striped rope and gyrating blob on one end. Kelly's rescue line. Perfect. No worries now. The steel beam sparked. Kurt reflexively let go, and arcs played across the alloy, radiation inducing a charge. Every display in his helmet exploded into static. Rows of status lights blinked amber, then all red. Life support, hydraulics, power all fluctuated and failed. He had to get out of here before that Shaw Fujikawa translite drive completely shut down his suit. The basic laws of physics still worked here. Action and reaction, energy transfer and momentum. He pushed off the beam, back to Fred and Kelly, hoping to grab the rescue line on his way. If he missed, they would still find him. The only thing he cared about right now was getting away from the source of his suit's malfunction. He drifted. With his suit shut down, all he could do now was coast and wait. Lightning struck. He was ground zero, and thunder kicked Kurt forward like a rag doll. He'd absorbed a near-direct grenade explosion once, and it had felt something like this. Only this particular explosion hadn't been near him. It had been on his armor. His first thought was sniper fire, an ambush. But then his vision cleared and he saw stars, the dull red binary suns, and Station Delphi whirling around. His TPAC had busted a line. He could feel the propellant gushing out. Even though the tanks had been designed with redundant shutoff valves and emergency self-sealing foam to prevent such a decompression. He heard CPO Mendes' voice in his head again. Start tumbling in this gear. Start praying.
Mayday! He called out. Suit malfunction! Mayday!
Kurt had no idea where he was, where his team was now positioned, or how fast he was rocketing away from them. Of course they didn't open radio channels on this mission. Point-to-point single-beam lasers carried their comm signal. Gyrating out of control, any signal that hit a tiny Spartan-sized target in the vast volume of open space would be nothing short of a miracle. He finally got enough bearings to tap the system override. No response. He hit the harness emergency release. It was jammed. I'm okay, he said over the comm. Life support's minimal but still functional. Going to deep breathing mode to conserve air and power. I'll ride it out. You should be able to pick up my IFF transponder once I'm clear. Activating rescue beacon now. I'll be okay. I'll be okay.